Starting to sour. Are we well equipped to make the scientific decisions that will affect the future of humankind? Tonight, live from the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario, do we still believe in science?
Tonight, on The Agenda with Steve Pakin.
And this new finding raises more ethical questions.
Challenging your beliefs.
Is this kind of research going to create a market for human eggs?
From stem cell research.
Stem cells are the future of medicine.
Only people in wheelchairs know how difficult it is.
Days-old human embryos must be destroyed to harvest the cells.
To test tube babies.
We try and help patients have a single healthy offspring. I would never thaw six embryos and put back six embryos in a patient like this. It's just not, it's not what we do.
And artificial intelligence.
I can tell you that I'm sad.
But they're also able to read our emotions.
Pushing the scientific envelope.
Anytime you develop a therapy for one disease, people begin to recognize, hey, I could potentially use that for the condition I'm treating.
And testing our tolerance.
Science and religion may never see eye to eye, and yet we're all struggling to understand our universe better.
Can science make a believer out of you?
Well, I think God wants us to use our brain. And our brain is showing us that we can do certain things without manipulating the dignity of the human person.
I hope that they will achieve something through this research that will ultimately help others, if not me.
Do we still believe in science? Part 5 of The Agenda at the Q2C Quantum to Cosmos Festival. That's tonight on The Agenda.
The Agenda with Steve Pakin. Funding for The Agenda with Steve Pakin is provided by Vale Inco Limited, a pioneering nickel mining company transforming mineral resources into essential ingredients for everyday life. Ontario's 33,000 chartered accountants, public policy leaders since 1879. More information is available at casforchange.ca. And by contributions to TVO by viewers like you. Thank you.
Hi again, everybody, and welcome back to the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics here in Waterloo, Ontario. We are at Q2C, the Quantum to Cosmos Festival. This is the final night of 5 intriguing and fascinating programs on everything from space exploration to designer genetics. And we've got, thankfully, another full house here at the Perimeter Institute. Thanks to everybody for coming out on what's a very wet night here in Waterloo, but obviously hasn't dampened your spirits this evening. For those of you who are watching us at home, you can participate in the discussion as well. Our fifth column blogger, Mike Miner, as he has all week, is once again hosting a live chat on our Inside Agenda blog. Simply go to our homepage, tvo.org/theagenda, and join in that discussion, as well as getting all information you want about this Q2C festival. Now, to the main event tonight. In an increasingly skeptical world, are we losing our taste for a life shaped by science? To debate that, Natalie Angier, she is author and Pulitzer Prize-winning science columnist at the New York Times. Stuart Brand, president and co-chair of the Long Now Foundation and founder and editor of the Whole Earth Catalog. Nadia El-Awady, Cairo-based freelance journalist and president of the World Federation of Science Journalists. Michael Griffin of the University of Alabama and the former administrator of NASA. And Neil Turok, cosmologist and the director of this Perimeter Institute where we find ourselves tonight and have for the last 5. And Neil, first of all, thank you for your hospitality over the last 5 nights. We've had a great experience here. We also want to say, because some people may have seen the advertisements in the newspaper this morning, Mike Lazaridis, who built this place, of course, co-CEO of RIM, was supposed to be with us this evening, but he got sick and he's not able to be with us tonight. So Mike, we wish you a speedy recovery. Now, on to the discussion. Many of the most intense public debates have had science at the core. Think of nuclear power, genetically modified foods, cloned sheep, stem cell research, global warming. Natalie, to you first. Do people have a point when they suggest that innovations of this kind make them very uneasy?
Well, I think that people are very nervous about things that they don't understand. I think one of the problems is that most people never meet a scientist. If you spent as much time around scientists as I do, you would realize that they're actually pretty sensible, well-grounded people, and they're not ones to get kind of overexcited about things. And I think one of the reasons that they do have this groundedness is that they've learned to sort of weigh things in a rational way. And maybe if people took a tip from that, talk to a scientist at a cocktail party, you would start to see that maybe you don't have to get so sort of excited and hysterical about any issue that you're dealing with. You can sort of make a rational decision, look at the pluses and the minuses, and come to a conclusion about whether it's worth the risk.
Neil, are you a sensible and well-grounded person?
I'm not the right person to ask.
You're not. Not on this one. Not on this one. How about you?
I'm well-read. I'm a writer. I have to be.
You have to be. How about on the issue? Do you understand why people are a bit queasy about all of these innovations that we hear about?
It's new stuff, and it's consequential stuff. And so you immediately start to have an opinion about it, as you have an opinion about somebody running for office. You know, you've got a new technology that, in a sense, is running for office in your life. So you start forming an opinion, and then it kind of gets a momentum. And it may well be that it's too late to correct later when real knowledge enters the scene. And so people veer off in various directions.
Michael, how do we know which fears are well-founded?
Well, that's a difficult question to ask or to answer in advance. I mean, truthfully, we don't, because only in light of hindsight do we usually see which fears were well-founded. And so I think a better term to use about what's appropriate and not appropriate is, I think it's not useful to have fear. I think it is useful to recognize rationally that there are no unmixed blessings. There is no cloud that doesn't have, if you will, a dark pocket. There are downsides to every upside. So we are right to look at the possible consequences of innovations. But to do that, we actually need to use the scientific method to look rationally at the innovations we create to examine their potential impacts.
Nadia, you come here tonight from a part of the world where there is Egypt, a considerable amount of poverty compared to what we experience in the West. This fear of innovation, more intensely held in your part of the world?
No, we don't have a fear of innovation, but I'll tell you what we do have a fear of. There is a fear of some science. And as a science journalist, I can tell you that part of the reason for that fear is that we, as journalists, as the media, are not providing proper information about science. One of the problems that we have right now in Egypt, and I know that a similar problem exists in the United States, is the fear about the influenza vaccine, H1N1 vaccine. And one of the reasons why there is that fear is that the media is not communicating properly the proper scientific details about this vaccine. But the general population is getting the misinformation. They're getting the wrong details. They're getting the wrong information that causes fear. So as journalists, we have a very important role in communicating and being the bridge between the scientists and the general population to make sure that they get the right information and that they don't have unfounded fear.
Neil, I was going to touch on this later, but since it's been brought up right now, how much of this is journalism not doing its job, and how much of it is you folks are just very, very, you're very hard for us to understand sometimes?
Yeah, I think it's a huge challenge. The world is speeding up, science is speeding up, new discoveries are coming thick and fast, and we are not sure where they will lead us. I think there are good grounds to believe they are our best hope for the future if we are going to tackle the big problems facing the world, global warming and eventually going into space, which I hope Michael will talk more about. We need science and technology. They're absolutely essential, so they will drive our future. It's right for people to be nervous. That's a rational thing.
It's
rational to be nervous, but what it means is you have to realize the future will be what we make it. And so, yes, be nervous, but also keep yourself informed. Make sure your kids are well educated in science, because they will have to control this science and technology for the future.
Michael.
I think when we talk about fears or concerns about science, a question we have to ask ourselves is, what alternative would be better? It's hard to imagine the problem for which the solution is, I think I should remain more ignorant.
Okay. Well, you know what? Let's bring these up right now. Here's a survey. Who did this? The Pew Research Center for the People and the Press did this. This is only a few months old, on whether more good or more harm has been done. For example, when it comes to achievements in space. Michael, this is right up your alley. 74% of those surveyed view space achievement as having done more good, and only 17% say it's done more harm. How about achievements in genetics? 72% say more good. Only 19% say more harm. Achievements related to the internet? 70% say more good, 22% more harm. How about nuclear energy? Very controversially handled in the daily media. 65% still say it's represented more good. Only 27% say more harm. And the final question, the survey also asked if science and technology have made life easier for most people. And overwhelmingly, 83% say yes, 10% only say it's made life more difficult. Natalie, this would seem to suggest a really pretty high, pretty decent support across the population for science and the role it plays in our lives. If that's the case, who are the people who are questioning the value of science in our lives?
Well, first of all, you have to keep in mind that they're a vocal minority, I think, and the people who make a big fuss are the ones that get all the attention. So, for example, we were talking about the vaccines. There are some people who think that vaccines are bad for you, and they just keep coming back, and no matter how much the data overwhelmingly show that they're safe, and in fact they're great, and I think that anybody who doesn't have their kids vaccinated is just an irresponsible person, but they're so insistent and they are so relentless, and they are a small number of people and they make a lot of noise and they influence media coverage because they hold events and, you know, they get celebrities speaking for them, and it's unfortunate. And I don't feel as the media, it's entirely our fault, because, you know, it's a difficult balance between becoming an advocate for something and just reporting the news.
Nadia, if it's so obvious that vaccines are good and that those who speak against them are, as Natalie has said, a fringe who really don't represent the truth on this, why do journalists put them on the air? Why do we write about them?
Well, because they're part of the community. We have to be able to report all sides of any issue.
Even if one side isn't based in fact at all?
Well, as long as they're talking, I guess, journalists will end up having to address what they're talking about. For me, if I did speak with people like that, I would want to be able to speak with them to find out what issues they're raising and be able to take these issues to a scientist and have someone that has the information address these issues properly. So that would be my role. If I did raise issues like that, my role would be to provide the proper information, the proper answers to those questions.
I see. Neil?
Yeah, I think I want to take the side of the critics of science. Right, it's a bit dull if we all just say how great science is. Which is the following. I think many people feel that our nature as human beings is somehow not, is somehow being squashed by science. When you see kids on the internet, all the time, being drowned with all kinds of information and then requirements to learn all sorts of IT skills and do all their homeworks on computers and so on, it feels like this is somewhat against our nature as human beings. And so I feel it's very important for science to be seen as a human enterprise. For me, the ultimate was the Apollo moon mission, okay? What could be more human than these people going on this incredible adventure, which required bravery, technology, generated spin-offs? It got a whole generation of people interested in science and did incredible good. I mean, as you saw in your poll, it was the highest rated.
Yes.
Right? And that's how science should be seen. It's a human endeavor. We're human beings. We're trying to understand the world. And I think, in fact, events like this, the festival, your TV program, they are part of that, and I would say it's our responsibility as scientists to make it clear what we're doing is very human. As Michael said, we don't know what the future will bring. We're playing with these tools and trying to understand the world, we're not sure where that will lead us. Nobody can predict 10 years from now what the outcome of science will be. And it's up to us to involve people, to explain what we're doing as far as we can, but for people to enjoy science as a very human activity.
Stuart, let me put this to you. It seems that certain people from a certain ideological perspective have the same antipathy towards the same issues in science, and let me just a couple of obvious examples here. Stem cell research seems to make some conservatives more fearful than liberals. Conversely, genetically modified foods and nuclear power seem to make liberals more fearful than conservatives. Why is that?
I think a lot of it is where it comes from. When fluoridation of water first came along a few decades back, the right wing got all worked up and they had all these pseudoscientific reasons about why it was going to be bad for you. And then when genetically engineered food crops came along, my fellow environmentalists and people on the left got all worked up and came up with these pseudoscientific reasons about why it was going to be bad for you. Well, look at where they came from. The fluoridation came from government, so of course conservatives are going to be very suspicious of government pushing something down their throat. And to a large extent, genetic engineering came from corporations, so of course the left, and to some extent left-influenced environmentalists, will say, well, it must be bad if it's coming from Monsanto. And again, once they set down that path, then they start finding things that support the theory that got started by actually this other reason. But for me, an interesting case is we've been talking about the vaccine stuff, and people who are worried about vaccines seem to be across the political spectrum, you know, so much for my theory.
Well, government's pushing it on people, and private corporations make them, so there's lots of, for
yeah,
everybody to be nervous
in the,
about.
In the job here, but the thing that seems to be in common is it's children, that most of the people that really worked up are parents. And then I would compare that with in vitro fertilization a few years back. Parents were worked up about that. But then parents became the most rewarded because infertile couples became fertile couples. Everybody here probably knows families who have fabulous children who come through the IVF process. And those fears basically were gone within about 10 years, just gone.
Yeah.
Vaccine apparently hasn't had that same kind of positive reward. And we need to figure out some way that people do feel rewarded for getting vaccinated. Rather than just not getting sick, that something good happens. And then this might turn around.
Michael, follow up?
A follow up. I think Stuart makes a good point about vaccines, but I think a point to add is that our memory is not as long as it should be. My grandfather was one of 13 children, of whom 9 lived to see adulthood, and that was not untypical in the late 19th century. Almost no one alive today remembers a time when 20, 30, 40% of the children would die in childhood because now we have vaccines. Yes, vaccines occasionally result in an untimely death of an individual here or there, but 100 years ago, we saw the untimely deaths of 20, 30% of the children who were born. I think we've made a good trade.
That may be one reason why people had so many children 100 years ago, is they knew half of them might not make it to adulthood.
That's a fact.
Yeah. Let's bring up some more public opinion. Now, this one came out just yesterday, once again from the Pew Research Center. U.S. public opinion on global warming. Is there solid evidence, they asked, the Earth is warming? In August of 2006, 77% of respondents said, yes, there is solid evidence. How about this month? Only 57% said yes. Natalie, what do you infer from that?
Well, I think that probably corresponded with when Al Gore's movie was very popular, and so a lot of people saw it and they became influenced by that, and we haven't had that much of a good publicity run. I know that the White House has been trying to drum up support for this, but of course we now have healthcare reform and the economy to worry about, and apparently people are just putting that on the back burner. But I do think that Al Gore was a really good salesman for it. So that's what I would attribute it to.
Neil, do those numbers depress you?
A little bit, but I think the problem really is that the way in which governments are addressing global warming is very much at a policy level negotiations between states and so on, and the public doesn't feel very involved in that. This is all at a very high level and it doesn't involve you. What I'd love to see much more of is education around these issues among the schools and having kids looking at these questions, playing with the answers. You know, there should be a much greater level of familiarity with all the arguments among society than there is.
This is right in your wheelhouse. What do you think of those numbers?
They're a little worrying. I think one of the issues is, you know, as with Al Gore's movie, or with, you know, if we have a hurricane that people think bears something in relation to climate, or a lot of people die one summer in Europe because it's suddenly very hot, people think, okay, that's it, that's climate, and they're worried. The weird thing about climate is anything short of 10 years isn't really a signal yet. It's just, you know, stuff going on, it's weather. But once you get something, a drought that goes on more than 10 years, that's starting to be climate. And indeed, we see things like Darfur that are, you know, basically war set in motion by carrying capacity coming down because of climate-driven drought. I think it'll take a number of those things adding up before people get a sense of the whole planet is on the move in this large, slow, very difficult to stop way. And then you'll see the narrative of climate change dominate everything, perhaps too much. Everybody will interpret everything in terms of climate change. That's not right either.
Nadia, is this an issue that preoccupies people in the Arab world?
Climate change?
Yes.
Recently, yes. I think it took us some time to start being preoccupied by climate change compared to the rest of the world. I don't think we started understanding that climate change could have an impact on warmer countries. And it took time for the research also to start appearing on how climate change can impact areas like Egypt and the Arab world. And in Egypt, as an example, there's now research that says that our Delta region, which is the triangle where the two branches of the Nile meet, this area of Egypt is threatened to be flooded with the Mediterranean Sea. So this research is starting to come out, and now because this research is starting to come out and people are starting to discuss these things, people are starting to have an understanding that this is something that we need to really look into.
And let me follow up with this. You were in the audience last night when we did our program about robotics, and I wonder whether questions about the future of new technologies resonate, again, with people in the Arab Middle East?
For us, new technologies means a new mobile, a new laptop, the little gadgets that we play around with. But we're not at the stage where we think of technology, meaning robots and artificial intelligence, and we're not there yet. One of our problems in Egypt is that we have a 70% literacy rate. That means that 30% of our population above the age of 15, they still need to learn how to read and write. So things like artificial intelligence, they're just way out of our radar.
Stuart.
Nadia, is texting on cell phones changing the literacy rate?
Well, it depends on how you define literacy in that case. Because in Egypt, for example, we communicate in the Arabic language. And what you'll find now is that the English language is being used to communicate Arabic, and we use numbers and English letters to communicate the Arabic language, and it's just completely changing how we communicate, but we do use a lot of text messaging. Uh-huh.
Okay, yes, Neil, let me try this with you. 50 years ago, the novelist and scientist C.P. Snow delivered a rather famous lecture bemoaning the lack of communication between those who are in the sciences and those who are in the humanities.
Yeah.
Is the divide between, I guess, what we in Canada would call the two solitudes as great today as it was back then?
In general, yes. I think I would make this a much broader critique of universities. Universities have become too compartmentalized into departments who don't speak to each other. And academic disciplines tend to be much, you know, narrowly defined and almost to compete with each other for attention and for funding and so on, which is completely counter to the whole idea of knowledge, you know, as a common possession. of humanity. So I think new institutions like this, I don't want to toot our horn too much, but new institutions like this try to be interdisciplinary, to involve other disciplines. This whole week has been an event involving people from many different fields.
Let me go to Michael on this, because you obviously make your living on a university campus right now, University of Alabama in Huntsville.
I do.
Is he speaking truth to you on this?
I think there's some truth, certainly. Academic institutions and the teaching of knowledge and the learning of knowledge tends to be very compartmentalized. I have spent a professional lifetime, almost 40 years, in science and engineering, and my contribution has always been to cross disciplines. So there is some truth to what Neil says, but at the same time, I think today, in all fairness, there is such an amount of coverage of science and engineering and technology in the media that even my liberal arts friends and my entertainment industry friends are fairly conversant with at least the surface layers of what goes on in science and engineering. So there's been some progress. Now, I think it's worth pointing out that C.P. Snow, however, was not talking about that surface awareness of each other's disciplines. The question that C.P. Snow posed in his paper, in his lecture, Two Cultures, was he directly stated that most of his scientific friends would be able to make a knowledgeable comment about, say, a Shakespearean play, but that no great Shakespearean would be able to make a knowledgeable comment about special relativity. He was talking about the next layer down below the surface commentary in these disciplines, and I think that, in fact, is as bad as it ever was.
I really want to hear what you've got to say on this, Natalie, because you work for the New York Times, where I'm betting you could make an intelligent comment about something happening in the Obama administration, but people who cover politics for your paper couldn't necessarily do the same thing about the stuff you cover.
No,
is that true?
I think it's very true, and it's actually sometimes a little bit upsetting to me that that it's acceptable to be ignorant about this, whereas if you were to say that you were ignorant about what was going on in the Obama administration or in the Middle East or whatever, that would be a sign of you're not doing your job, not being aware of what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. But it's perfectly fine to ghettoize science, and that is, oh, I could tell you so many stories about the editors that I've dealt with and things that they've said that make me realize.
Tell us. They're a bunch of idiots, aren't they?
Well, one story about how when an editor was editing a piece I had written about whale genetics, and he's going over it, and so he stops me midway because I had referred to whales as mammals. He said, "So whales are mammals?" And I said, "Yeah." And then a little bit later, I used the word animals. He said, "Mammals are animals?" And
the New York Times.
Yeah, I didn't quite know whether he was being entirely serious or just very diligent wanting to get it, but I realized that I kind of take a lot for granted and maybe shouldn't. And in fact, I think anyone who writes about science learns that lesson over and over and over again, that you should never take anything for granted. But you shouldn't take anything for granted you shouldn't take for granted that people know where Mexico is, or you could point it out on a map, or that it's part of North America. I mean, there are a lot of sources of ignorance in the world, but then again, people maybe know things that I have no idea about, so.
Stuart, you got a view on this?
I think one thing that's changed since Snow's time is there's a lot more writers are coming from scientists themselves. And so you have an Edward O. Wilson winning not one but two Pulitzer Prizes for his writings, and half the physicists we know seem to be writing books, and good books, well-written books. Now, it may well be that the New York Times' book review won't review their books because they're reviewing some novelist's third bad novel. But nevertheless, it gets out there, and I think the point that Michael is making is that scientists tend to embrace the humanities much more than the humanities are embracing the sciences. And I guess, you know, you just have to get to the point where, you know, it's all scientists embracing humanities, and then you're okay.
We're about, Michael, go ahead, one quick comment.
I think where we are today is that there is still a problem, because at least in America, if you don't know who won the Super Bowl, you're regarded as an object of laughter. If you don't know anything about the Hubble Space Telescope of dark energy, that's okay.
Yeah. Natalie, who won the Super Bowl last year?
I'm just hoping that the Yankees make it into the series.
Football, Natalie, football.
Yeah. Ha, ha, ha. No, I have no idea. None.
Nor do I.
Nor do you.
Oh,
I have
see?
No idea.
But you both know about the Hubble telescope, but you don't know who won the Super Bowl.
I have no idea.
You know
idea.
What? I bet none of you knows who won the Super Bowl last year. Who won the Super Bowl last year?
It's me.
Okay, ask the audience.
But see.
Who won the Super Bowl last year? Shout it out. Steelers. Somebody knows. All right. Good, okay. good. Neil, you wanted to say.
Yes, I think an example of this, the culture of the arts versus the sciences, a very good example. In fact, C.P. So was writing about the UK, and this is true, that in the UK, most top civil servants and most politicians come from arts backgrounds, not sciences. And even within the business community, you find the number of people in the UK with a science background is who are actually managing the big deals is rather small. It's mostly people from arts backgrounds. And I would in fact say that the financial crisis, when you look at the causes of it, a lot of it was bad science because people were doing modeling based on faulty assumptions. And so it works for a while, but they simply didn't allow in their models the phenomenon of catastrophic runaway and failure, and that's exactly what happened. So I think that's been a great lesson to, it should be a great lesson to science and to finance, that we need science, we need, and it's not enough just to people for people to have a generic arts education and to put on a suit and tie and become captains of industry. That's not acceptable.
Well, when you meet someone at a high level, in China or India,
they
come from an engineering
they
or
do.
Science background.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's a stunning difference.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think everything I'm hearing is that actually conducting negotiations with such people is a lot easier because there's this common understanding of science. And I would mention I'm from Africa. In Africa, it's actually very noticeable that some of the leading figures, the leading ministers across Africa, are coming through from science backgrounds, and these are known to be people who are more objective, less prone to, arbitrary decisions, and so on. So I think science will play a more and more important role.
I will confess I'm not an expert on the Hubble telescope, but I do know who won the Super Bowl last year. Anyway, we're about two-thirds of the way through the program, and let me do a little business with the folks at home. We're going to take a minute to remind everybody that we are broadcasting live tonight from the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Ontario, all part of TVO's ongoing coverage of the Q2C Quantum to Cosmos Festival. If you can't be here with us tonight, you can always join us online at our homepage, tvo.org/theagenda. Our fifth column blogger, Mike Miner, is hosting a live chat right now on our Inside Agenda blog. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/theagenda using the Your Agenda hashtag. Also online, all of the broadcasts that we've done this week, as well as our web-exclusive Imagine the Future videos. All that, plus complete festival coverage in live streaming video, video on demand, on our homepage, tvo.org/theagenda. Okay, I'm going to go to the audience in a second, but first we've got this question from online. Robert says, science can't answer the why question, only the how question. That's why many people don't find comfort in it. I'm seeing some nodding of heads here. Yes, you agree, Neil?
Yeah, I think so. I think there are lots of things science can't answer yet.
Yet.
Maybe one day we will.
It.
But for example, I think there's nothing that compares with the smell of fresh grass or soil or walking through a tropical rainforest. I mean, that's a very human experience which science so far cannot replicate nor understand. And I think science needs to be modest. I believe science has just scratched the surface of this incredibly powerful thing called knowledge about the world, and this will grow over time.
Okay, question back here, please. Yes, sir.
My question is, 60 to 70 years from now, will we be able to look back and say to our children that the belief in science brought us forward or that it's taking us away?
Michael, what do you say to that?
I think the history of human society since the Renaissance shows us that if we look back across any 60 or 70 year period, we see truly that we are better than we were before. We're not as good as we want to be, and we can all look back at our own lives and at the progress of society and say there are plenty of mistakes to find. But if you average it out, we're better than we were before, and 60 years from now, we'll be better than we are today.
Way here in the back, please. Yes, sir.
Besides good science, as Neil mentioned, there is bad science. So I was thinking, can we increase the trust in science by having the society processes by which to check if bad science is done?
How do we check and make sure we get good science, not bad science? Stuart, you want to have a whack at that one?
That's scientific method is in the constant debate and argument that scientists earnestly have with each other with great glee is about. You're constantly sorting out the not-so-good science from the terrific science. Sometimes it takes a decade or two, and that's the process.
Okay, stand up if you would, sir. Kevin, you got this okay? All right, here we go.
My question is primarily for Dr. Griffin. It's about a recession and the economic impact of science. And I'm wondering, here in Waterloo, we have huge, enormous impact of science on our community, thousands of spin-offs. Do they have the same impact of the university in Huntsville, or do they have a recession economy?
Michael, you want to take that one?
Sure. Actually, in northern Alabama, where I'm located, it turns out that that is one of the very highest concentrations in the United States of scientific, technical, computer science, mathematical talent because of the space industry, the aerospace industry that is there. That industry is divided between defense and civil space with NASA, and then spin-offs from those. But I would say that that region is enormously benefited by the conduct of scientific and engineering work which occurs there.
Over here, please.
This question is for Neil and then probably for the whole panel. How do we get more women involved? I know that there are more or less the same number of men and women who go to in higher education system, but once they're there in the hard sciences, it's mostly men. So, Neil, your question is, what's the ratio here at PI? And then for everybody else, how do you get more women involved? Because I think they'll probably, I hate to say it, make better decisions than most men would.
What's the ratio here at the Perimeter Institute, Neil?
Very bad. it's a huge embarrassment, and the ratio decreases as you go up the tree. And so one of the things we've taken on, and I take this very seriously, is I think Perimeter, because it is a much faster moving institution than a typical university would be, we have an obligation to be leaders in this respect. And so we've started a graduate program called Perimeter Scholars International, which is a master's level program. And we specifically prioritize searching for and encouraging young women graduates to come into theoretical physics. The tradition is very poor. If you look at the picture of the Solvay conference, you know, the great founders of our field in the 1920s, there's only one woman in it. The funny of Marie Curie, the great thing is she's the only one in that picture who won two Nobel Prizes.
Nadia, let's hear from you on this one.
I just read a statistic this morning that 30% of the workforce in Egypt is female. I don't think that's really all that bad. What happens in developing countries, and in Egypt as an example, is that you'll find a lot of women going into science as education, but once they finish their education, and I know that this is not only in Egypt, this is in many cultures, is that they have a responsibility not only to their career, but also to their families. And it's not a shared responsibility between men and women. And because this is a responsibility that the women are burdened with alone, that they have to take that responsibility, and they find it very difficult to balance the work, personal life, career balance.
Stuart, quick word on this?
Physicist Freeman Dyson has a theory on this, that it's the PhD requirement that is the great separator, because typically when you get a PhD, that's exactly the period a woman is wants to be starting a family, and it becomes this choice between family or going ahead with the science. And Freeman thinks you should just drop the PhD requirement and go with the quality of the science and the people, and if they got kids now, that's fine. But get away from this strange barrier that everybody has to go through.
Question here, please.
Do you see a disconnect between a willingness to use the products of science, the technology produced by science, and a willingness to incorporate the scientific method into everyday decision making and policy decision making?
Michael, you want to take that?
Yeah, and I even see it among scientists and engineers. we don't always practice in our daily lives what we're taught. Science in Latin, of course, comes from scientia, to know, and the Latin verb to know. And it, I think, accurately reflects that. And the scientific method is a systemization of a way of thinking combined with, as Stuart was talking about earlier, the value of openness and dialogue in science. Anytime that I hear somebody say scientific consensus, the alarm bells start to go off, because if it's consensus, it isn't science. When we think carefully, when we think carefully according to the methods that have evolved in science and mathematics and engineering, we generally do quite well. But it is a learned skill. It is a very much a learned skill. It is not instinctive to our species, and we have to be always on guard against dropping back. You see the vaccine argument that we talked about earlier was a classic example. Tens of thousands of children perished from the lack of vaccines, when today, if a child perishes, it makes national news, and we have no rational sense of how much we've improved as a result.
We're going to do another poll again in a second, but just before that, Dave from our live chat on our webpage has this question. Natalie, I'll put this to you. If science is important, why is it that scientists are making $41,000 a year with a PhD?
Well, I think it's because they're not working directly with money. I think that the way to make a lot of money is to work with money. And so if you're not working directly with it, it's hard to make a big salary. It's a problem. I mean, these people go through all these years of training, and then they come out and they can earn 40, maybe 60,000. And so you say, well, why should I devote so much time to it? I think we have to deal with the salary issue too.
Nadia, what do they make in the Middle East?
Oh.
Scientists.
That's right.
It's awful. My husband is top of his class. He's a medical doctor. And when he graduated and started working as a resident in Cairo University, medical staff, he was getting 200 Egyptian pounds a month. That is about $50 a month.
$50.
$50 a month. And that's top of his class. That's one of the best, you know, products of the medical field when he graduated. It's really, really bad.
Okay, let's put these numbers up here. On the eve of Darwin's 200th birthday, which was this past February, Gallup did this survey. 39% of Americans believe in the theory of evolution. 25% say they did not. And 36% said they had no opinion on this at all. Now, you're all laughing, but here comes the question. How do you explain the discrepancy, Neil, to you first, with those numbers we showed earlier, where people seem to have a pretty good view of science and a good belief in it, thought it had been a positive net benefit in our lives in so many ways, with this relatively significant disbelief in how we're here?
It's extremely significant, and I think it's a sign of a failing education system. I think the teachers are, through want of training or lack of being insufficiently valued in society, they are not conveying the story properly regarding evolution. I mean, the evidence for evolution is absolutely overwhelming. and anyone who looks rationally at the data will agree with that.
Nadia, the effect of religion on this question. I mean, presumably that's a factor too, is it not?
Well, let me tell you what's happening in the Arab world, in the Islamic world in general. It's the same thing that Neil's saying, is that we're not getting the information, and the information that we are getting is filtering through from the Christians in the United States, basically. And because in the Islamic world, we feel that we have an affinity with the Christians, with the people of the book, as we call them, what the Christians say must be true. But we're not getting the science. It's not reaching us. We're not taught evolutionism in schools. Evolutionism is not taught to biology students in faculties of science.
Why not?
I have no idea. I think part of it is because we have this idea in our heads, this misconception in our heads, that evolutionism is anti-religion. And the reason that we have this is that we're misinformed.
Stuart?
What if it doesn't matter? Edward O. Wilson again wrote a sweet book called The Creation that was basically written to Christians in America. And every chapter begins, Pastor. And he goes on about, we don't need to argue about Darwin. We both agree that God's creation, or what I think of as just the creation, needs to be protected. And he is invited to religious conferences to come and hold forth about environmental conservation. They don't need to talk about Darwin. So in some of these cases, look, if it's just going to make a lousy dinner party, stop talking about it. It's okay.
I really don't think it's okay.
I'm a biologist, so I believe it, but I'm trying it out.
I really don't think it's okay. I mean, I think taking kids out on a school trip where you find a fossil in the ground of a species which doesn't exist anymore on the planet, what could be more convincing? And that's not happening. And I see it's a failure of education.
We've got less than 5 minutes to go here, and let's finish up on where science is taking us. We talked earlier at the beginning of the program about the nervousness that some people feel with things that they don't understand so much about. So even though science operates in a world of fact and rigorous methodology, it still, on behalf of the greater, not so scientifically aware population, requires a bit of a leap of faith for us to put ourselves in your hands and assume that you're doing right by us. A bit of a paradox here. You appreciate that makes us queasy, Neil?
Definitely. I think you're right to be queasy. Mm-hmm. I think our best bet, take this institute. We're supported by public funds. Mm-hmm. This is a public-private partnership, but we're well aware of the fact that the public are supporting us, and we view it as our responsibility not only to do great science and for the benefit of humanity, but to communicate it.
Natalie, who oversees these people?
Who oversees
the scientists? Make sure they don't do crazy things.
That's a good question, but I think people should get more involved in kind of amateur interest in science. I think that would make a big difference. They recently had on the White House lawn, they had astronomy night, and they had all these telescopes set up, and Obama's daughters were there looking, and they declared it was like the most exciting night of their life. And so you can look up at Jupiter's moons, and that can be a life-changing experience. Get a good binocular microscope, and just look at anything. Look at a mosquito under a microscope, and it will change your whole worldview. And then you'll feel part of the process, I think. The more you can have some direct experience, go out and find a fossil. These are all experiences that I think bring you into the world of discovery.
A couple of minutes to go, let me get a couple of you on this issue. What is it about science, Nadia, that you are most grateful for?
I think what makes me most grateful about science is the sense of discovery. I remember when I was a child, I'd visit my father in his lab. He's a chemist. And I'd take my fellow students to the lab with me. And he'd do these little very simple experiments. He'd make a volcano out of little different chemicals that he had, and it would explode. And it's just that sense of discovery, of finding something new, of learning something different.
Michael, how about you?
I guess I'm most personally grateful for my vision. I have extremely poor vision without the advantage of modern gas permeable contact lenses that allow me to see and to fly my own plane. And if I were born in 1899 instead of 1949, my vision is so poor I might never have learned to read. I certainly wouldn't hold the kinds of jobs I've held. And I think if your viewers think about their own histories or people in their family, everyone can write that own personal story. So when I look back at the world in 50, 60 years, I always see that we're better than we were. I would ask your viewers one final question. The concerns about the unintended consequences of science are real and they are rational. But do you really think remaining ignorant is a better choice? Yeah.
Are you afraid of what you might get back if you ask that question?
No.
You're not?
No. No, I'm not.
Take the last 20 seconds. Tell me what you're grateful for, Neil, in terms of science.
In terms of science? For me, science is a miracle. It's the fact that we have been somehow given the capacity to understand the world and predict its behavior. I think this is the most beautiful thing in our existence.
Well put. That's our time for this evening, and I want to thank all of our guests for coming from very near and very far to be with us this evening. I'm grateful to this audience for coming out on a rainy night here in Waterloo to be with us as well. And I now want to tell you about a bunch of online stuff we've got available to you. For more information about our guests on tonight's program, futurist Bill Joy's Worries About the Future, web-exclusive video of leading scientists answering the question, where do you see our future in the next 50 to 100 years, and complete Q2C festival coverage, go once again to our homepage, tvo.org/theagenda. Tonight's program was produced by Vodek Schemberg and Sandra Gionis. My thanks to the two of you for such a great job all week long. Sandra's got the post tonight on our homepage, Science and Inspiration. You'll find that on our Inside Agenda blog, also online, tvo.org/theagenda. Stay with us. We got what do we do next? We're going to have a little more that you're going to want to stick around for because we're not quite done. In the meantime, watch this video. We'll be right back.
What forces have sought to destroy literacy throughout the ages?
Become immersed in the thrilling online companion to TVO's upcoming series, Empire of the Word, and participate in an interactive mystery of ancient puzzles and secret societies.
Unlock the mystery at tvo.org/empireoftheword and watch the magic of reading reveal itself.
Empire of the Word, the game, online exclusively at tvo.org/empireoftheword.
For 10 days in October, Waterloo will be the center of the scientific universe. The Quantum to Cosmos Festival will bring the world's brightest minds together to discuss everything from quarks to black holes. TVO is proud to be the official broadcaster of the event. The agenda will come to you live from the Perimeter Institute during the week of October 19th through 23rd. Our guests will be world-renowned leaders in their fields, giving us great insight into some of the foremost science-related questions of the day. The Quantum to Cosmos Festival on the agenda. Plan on being a part of it, October 19th through 23rd at 8 p.m.
Funding for the agenda with Steve Paikin is provided by Valley Inco Limited, a pioneering nickel mining company transforming mineral resources into essential ingredients for everyday life. Ontario's 33,000 chartered accountants, public policy leaders since 1879. More information is available at casforchange.ca. And by contributions to TVO by viewers like you. Thank you.
Well, this has been a wonderful week for us here at TVO, here at the Perimeter Institute. We have really enjoyed working with you guys and passing on all of this knowledge about science, or as much as we can, over the 5 hours that we've been here all week. John Matlock is here from the Institute, and I wonder, we're done tonight, but you guys are going through the weekend, right? So what's left?
You bet, and we can't thank you enough for coming down here with all the programming all week long. But all weekend long, we have a number of talks, public lectures, debates. We have Science in a Pub. We have the Physica Fantastica exhibit for those people who want to come into Waterloo and do the hands-on and dirty physics experiments. We have a science fiction film festival. We have playbacks of The Quantum Tamers. We have Alice and Bob online. So really what you have to do is come to q2cfestival.com, check out the full range of programming. It's all there to download and watch live online.
Neil Turek, highlight of the week for you.
I think the whole week has been incredible. I think it was very courageous of your TV station, if I say so myself.
5 days on science,
to jump in.
Are we pushing it?
Into an institute full of blackboards and geeky physicists to expect this would be fun. But no, I think it's worked very well. Highlights for me, I think the discussions about whether technology, computers, virtual reality, and so on are turning us into gadgets, or if they're under our control, that was very interesting. The discussion of where computers are going, quantum computers, the fact that the physics of the computer is now becoming vital to the whole process, that will change the nature of computing. As we go down to super miniaturization towards the scale of the atom, I thought that was interesting. And then the quantum tamers, I thought, was brilliant. I mean, it managed to turn physicists into movie stars. Who would imagine they were capable? But they actually made a pretty good go at it, I thought.
You're ready for your close-up, Mr. DeMille. Okay. Thanks to both of you for your help all week long. It's been a great week for us also.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. How am I doing on time? Minute left? Okay, that's enough time to read this. That is the agenda for October 23rd, 2009, the last, as we suggested, of our five programs here at the Perimeter Institute. As we just heard, the festival continues until Sunday, as does TVO's online coverage. For more information about that, special features including video on demand, our Ask a Scientist segments, and the rest of TVO's scientific literacy program, tvo.org/theagenda is where to go. I'm Steve Paikin. Thanks for watching TVO. For joining us online at tvo.org, we'll see you Monday back in Toronto, but we say goodnight for now from the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Ontario. So long, everyone.